Today on Off Mic, COVID-19 numbers are going through the roof in Indiana, but the virus may even be more troubling than first thought. We speak to a professor who led a study of Hoosiers and the effects the virus is playing on our state. We talk to two young brothers who develop an app that makes shopping locally a little bit more safe during this pandemic. And even though carnivals aren't happening this summer, we talk to the author of a new book about his experience as a traveling carny. And baseball is back for the North and South Siders. What are their chances of winning the World Series in this shortened season? All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lake Shore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana reporter for WBEZ. Well, back in mid-June, it appeared that Indiana had flattened that curve with just over 200 cases on June 7th. This week, Indiana recorded its biggest one-day total of 954 confirmed cases. Indiana now has a statewide total of nearly 60,000 positives and nearly 2,700 deaths. In Northwest Indiana, the region has recorded nearly 9,000 positive cases, with the city of East Chicago leading the way with the highest infection rate in the region at 2.2%. As a way to combat the spread, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb is requiring Hoosiers to wear face masks beginning Monday. What does this all mean? It means things could get worse before they start to get better. Dr. Nir Menachemi is professor of health policy and management at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He recently led a survey of randomly selected Hoosiers and made some astonishing findings about COVID-19. Dr. Menachemi, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you.
Doctor, your study concluded that COVID-19 is six times deadlier than the flu, and 2.8% of the state has been infected. What else can you tell us about this study?
So, our study was just published this week, and the data for wave one of our study, which is what the publication was based on, occurred at the end of April. Since then, we've done another random sample and are planning a third and a fourth. But I want to talk for a second about what the idea underpinning this random sample is and what motivated the study. So almost everything that we know about this disease comes from patients. And everything we know about the symptomology, everything we know about how severe it is, comes from a small fraction of people who end up coming to the hospital. And if you almost imagine a pyramid of everyone who's infected, where all the way at the top of the pyramid are people who die, right below that are people who are hospitalized, right below that are people who go to the doctor because they're not doing well, right below that are people with symptoms but don't go to the doctor because they're not serious enough, and below that are people who are infected but have no symptoms. Everything that we have known so far has been driven by people at the top of the pyramid, and that may or may not be true about the people at the bottom of the pyramid. And because there's been a shortage of tests just about everywhere in the United States since the pandemic has started, we have had to, you know, make decisions on who to deploy those COVID tests on. And we've used really the CDC's guidelines, which were logical. It's use them on the people who are most severe and the sickest and the highest risk. So when you kind of put that all together, everything we know comes from people who are the sickest and the highest risk, and we know very little about everyone else. For example, we didn't know how many people were asymptomatic. We didn't know how many people who get infected die, in part because we never knew how many people were infected. All we knew was how many cases there were. And recall, cases are a function of who gets tested, and not everyone gets tested. So cases are always an underestimation, but an unknown amount of how much they're underestimating infection. So with all that said, in late April, we did a random sample of Indiana residents based on people who filed taxes. And so if you filed, co-filed, or were a dependent listed on someone's tax return in the state of Indiana, We put you in our denominator, randomly selected you. And randomly selected is really important, in part because if we can't test everyone, how else can you get a representative sample other than by random selection? Random selection means without a pattern. And so given a large enough sample size, the people who are randomly selected should be representative of everyone else in the state. And we ended up randomly testing somewhere in the neighborhood of about 4,000 people, and were able to generate that 2.8% of infections for the state. And we tested both for active virus and antibodies, so we know who was currently infected and who was previously infected. And that gave us that really important denominator, really first in the U.S. denominator, of how many people in a state have been infected cumulatively to that time point.
Why do you think Indiana was first with that number? Is it because other states have just not, are just been inundated, but or do you just have that sort of that testing to the point where you were able to get that?
So we have worked now with about a dozen and a half states who have all been trying to replicate some aspect of our study. And I think a few things played into our situation. First and foremost, this was something that the governor wanted. When I got a call from the governor's office saying, we want to make data-driven decisions about when to reopen and how to do things, what kinds of information do you recommend we have? This was the first thing I said. If we can do this, it's unbelievably logistically challenging. And they basically said from the governor's office, this is something the governor wants. We will make it happen. Tell us what is needed. And that was ultimately why I think Indiana was able to do this. This was something the governor is willing to get behind on day one.
Are you surprised by the findings, or does it? I mean, for me as a layperson, it kind of scares me. But what does it do for you?
Yeah. So as a researcher, we want to know. Like, we don't have preconceived notions. I mean, the main purpose of doing this was to determine how many people were infected. If it was a little bit alarming, it was because it was so low. At the time, we didn't overwhelm the healthcare system in the states, but we certainly challenged it. There were major hospital systems that were pushing capacity in their ICU. And then when we turn around and find out that was only 3%, less than 3% of the population infected, that starts scaring people, because what happened if it was twice that? What happens if it was 10 times that? That's what happened in some other countries and maybe in early New York City. But we are still very vulnerable to a significant surge that can overwhelm the healthcare systems, even in the most advanced areas of the country.
Now, part of your testing also shows that minority communities, especially the Hispanic community, have been hit harder by the virus. In Northwest Indiana alone, we've been looking at a city of East Chicago, Indiana, which has the highest percentage of Hispanic residents of any city in Indiana, and has one of the highest rates of COVID-19 in Northwest Indiana. Did the findings surprise you with that?
I wouldn't say it surprised us. Minorities in general, Hispanics in particular, are significantly more likely to be employed in essential jobs. That means they don't have the ability to social distance. They didn't have the ability to shelter in place. They might have been exposed significantly more. It's just more challenging for them to take a day off from work when it might even affect their livelihood if they're hourly wage. Put that into the context of Latino, Latinx families in general are more likely to live in larger family structures that includes people beyond the nuclear family. And so you have a lot of people living maybe together, perhaps to some degree in smaller confined spaces. And if at least one of them is in a higher risk of being infected because they're being exposed more, you could see how that can, within the household, result in much higher infection rates, and for the community overall, be much larger than in other areas of the state. And that's what we think might have been playing a role in the higher rates that we observed in Indiana.
You know, do you believe, or I know you don't have any data to suggest this, but we've been told that perhaps areas that maybe have problems with pollution, air pollution, may also affect someone's propensity to perhaps get COVID-19.
So places that have pollution are also more likely to be lower income neighborhoods where you probably have disproportionately people in these hourly essential worker jobs. And so I don't know that we know for sure whether pollution itself causes more infections or if it's just correlated with the other social and economic factors associated where higher levels of pollution exist. But all of those are still important research questions that I know my colleagues and I are very interested in pursuing.
And doctor, a lot of people are still comparing COVID-19 with the flu. Why has it in the past? Why hasn't the flu shut down our economy or closed down schools like this virus has?
Oh, great question. So COVID-19 is nothing like the flu. First and foremost, the flu, we have a way to prevent it. It's called a vaccine. And yes, in some years it works better than in other years, based on how good the vaccine ends up predicting the type of, you know, specific strains of the flu virus that are going to circulate later on in that year when flu season hits. And so that's number one. We have a way to prevent a lot of infections with the flu. Number two, you know, in our study, we found that almost half of people who were actively infected had no symptoms. They were totally asymptomatic. And so half of the people who are infected with COVID might be going around and spreading it. I think the asymptomatic rate for the flu is less than 10% on a bad year. And so people self-isolate almost instantly. I know when I had the flu a couple of years ago, I went straight to bed, didn't want to talk to anyone, didn't want to spread it to anyone because I didn't have the energy to move around. And so the treatments, we also have a treatment for flu, which lessens the bout when you get infected. And so take these things in sum, you have the flu can be prevented. It can be treated to lessen the symptoms. You have a very low asymptomatic rate and people self-isolate themselves by going straight to bed. That doesn't happen with COVID. And it's also more deadly. And so it's almost like the perfect storm from a public health infectious disease containment scenario that influenza just doesn't challenge in the same way.
Let me ask you this. Already there's been a lot of discussion about whether schools should be having in-person teaching. Should students return to the buildings? The governor has also weighed in and saying Hoosiers should be wearing masks come Monday. And that includes school children if they go into these schools. What is, not getting into the politics or the enforceability of such a rule, but can, in your estimation, can masks save either lives or, you know, prevent infections from even going higher?
So there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that all the public health measures that are being recommended are effective. And in fact, they're being increasingly supported by the evidence. You know, I think early on, especially on masks, the jury was still out. We just didn't have enough good research. We now have really good research on masks being very protective. A couple of things that come to mind is, first and foremost, studies that looked at whether or not locales, cities, and areas where masks became required, they saw significant reductions in the case counts that places that didn't pass these laws did not experience. Separately, and there was a recent study in MMWR that followed two hairdressers, I think they were, that it turned out one of them ended up being positive. Both were wearing masks, and they tracked 150-some-odd patrons that they had in those hair salons and tested all of them, all of whom were wearing masks because they were required, and no one got infected, even though one of the hairdressers themselves was infected. And so that's an example in the real world where masks appeared to have blocked the ability of the infection. from at least infecting more than 100 and some odd people. And so we have real-world experience. We know that this works. In fact, I would argue the only thing we know that works are social distancing, the hand and surface hygiene, absolutely the masks, no congregating in large settings, especially not indoors. And, you know, politics aside, we are all in this together. The economy is something that we all share. No one person owns it. And so it's sometimes, I think, challenging to get the message across that adhering to these issues are not taking away freedoms. They're helping assure that everyone can have the freedoms of having some sense of normalcy in their life. And so we can open up and do it foolishly, whether it's the schools, the economy, the businesses, or we can open up and do it vigilantly, thereby assuring that we have that privilege right now in society. And I'd love to see more people get behind the doing it vigilantly.
Doctor, I just have one more question about the study you conducted. Here in Northwest Indiana, we always feel isolated from the rest of Indiana. And perhaps, you know, because we're so close to Chicago, maybe our numbers are skewed because of that influence of such a large city. But can you say if your random sample included anybody who lived in Northwest Indiana?
Yes, it did. And they had some of the highest rates compared to the other parts of the state, which we believed was a spillover effect from living in the largest city in the region. You know, public transportation, congregate living, being able to be in these small, you know, confined spaces, which are all characteristics of large cities, have spillover effects on the communities around them. And so that probably is one of the reasons that Northwest Indiana appeared to have rates higher than many other areas of the state.
Doctor, any final thoughts on this important work?
I think the most important message is we're all in this together, and it requires an all-hands-on-deck approach. You asked about the schools, and I'll just mention something about the kids. I'm a parent myself. I don't know that opening up the schools, the worry is not necessarily the children, and I've seen that sometimes be used as the argument, well, you know, the death rate in children is very low or very few of them ever get hospitalized. Why are we worried? It's not necessarily the health of the children that we're worried about. Although if it's your kid who's the unlucky one, obviously we want to prevent that. But it's the teachers. It's the staff. It's the cafeteria workers. It's the bus drivers. It's grandma and grandpa who come and visit the child. That what we're trying to prevent is the children from becoming vectors that spread the disease to everyone else who's potentially vulnerable. And so even if you're not worried about the child being sick and, you know, being hospitalized or dying, we're worried about everyone that that child has in their loved ones, in their life that might be vulnerable and might promote the spread. And so going back to what I said before, we can do anything vigilantly or we can do it irresponsibly. I hope that when we do something, we do it vigilantly and adhere to everything that we know can reduce the spread of the virus.
Dr. Nir Menachemi is professor of health policy and management at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Doctor, thank you for joining me here on Off Mic.
No problem. Thank you.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
The governor says masks are mandatory. The attorney general says you can't do that. Plus, Democrats are calling for a special session to deal with COVID funding, police reform, and vote by mail. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll go over the week's biggest statewide headlines and hear from the author of a new book on the Olympic athletes who came out of IU. And a new Notre Dame study suggests many people were isolating themselves at the beginning of the pandemic before the state orders came down. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. With COVID-19 all around us and mask mandates about to be in place, it can still be a little confusing as to what businesses are actually following the rules. Well, two young brothers from Munster may have a solution for you. 18-year-old Jack and 15-year-old Sam Landmesser developed the Safe Shopper app for iPhones. I asked Jack, what is the Safe Shopper app?
The Safe Shopper app was designed after, it's actually designed during quarantine when our mom would come home after shopping and she would kind of make her own little database with all of her friends and family about which businesses were taking which protocols. And so she'd come home and we'd be like, Mom, there's got to be an app for that somewhere. And sure enough, we looked and there wasn't. So we decided to make one. So we started back in April, middle of April, and we kind of just built a basic, like, web-based app, and we sent it out to our family to kind of test, and it wasn't really intuitive for them to download the app off the web. We really needed it to be on the App Store, so we enlisted the help of a Apple-certified developer to kind of guide us through the process of getting approved for the App Store, so we got approved a couple weeks ago for the App Store, which is definitely a tough process. So the app itself is supposed to provide a little bit of peace of mind for shoppers so they can kind of gather information about where they're shopping and what protocols those businesses are taking.
Jack, let me ask you this. What was compelling your mom to compile this list? I know Julie, I guess, is your mom and your press agent because she helped set up this interview, so I have to thank her. But do you know why was she coming home and why was she creating this list in the first place?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I'm not too sure, but what I can say is we've taken the safety during this whole time very seriously. And she wanted to make sure that she was making the right decisions about where she was shopping for our family, for family safety during this time.
Sam, how many local businesses do you have on there? What kind of information would I find on this app?
So right now we have over 200 businesses, and those businesses range across different retailers, different restaurants, and entertainment places. And we have 12 states right now in the U.S. And throughout those states, obviously, there's all these businesses. And in each business on our app, you can see what protocols they're taking and different reviews from customers about what they thought when they visited that business.
So it's sort of like Yelp, but for COVID-19?
Yes.
All right. Do the restaurants or the businesses, do they have to volunteer to be part of it? What if you get a business who says, well, I don't really want to be on this app?
So the businesses do not have to be involved at all. So our app is pretty much crowdsourced. And so all the businesses that have been added are added by the users themselves. So the businesses don't really need to be involved too much. We can always take a business off if they request that they don't want to be on the app anymore. But if a business owner comes to us and wants to put their app or their business on our app, then we have a special procedure we can do that can actually verify their business within the app. So that way other users know, like, this business has been added by the business owner themselves.
And may I add to that, we also, when you add a business on our app, there is a checkbox where you can click if you are or if you aren't the business owner when you add it. So that also helps that verification process.
And are most of your businesses mostly in Indiana, in your area of the woods, Munster, Highland area?
Majority of them are. But we do have, like you said, 12 states. We have businesses in 12 different states, but a majority of them are definitely in the Midwest and mostly kind of within the Indiana, Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland area.
And it's got to be helpful in that, you know, with these, you know, just in Northwest Indiana, there are some businesses that are, you know, conforming to this use of face masks and that. So if I go to the app, I can find out which, like, sort of businesses require a mask to go in or other protocols?
Yes, exactly. So you can see in the app what businesses are requiring face masks, what businesses are having their employees wear face masks, and so on. You can even see, like, what businesses have sneeze shields and what businesses have floor markers. Pretty much everything that you would require to be able to safely shop there, we have on the app.
Wow, that is helpful. And what was the response to your app? Are people leaving messages like, hey, this is just a wonderful tool to have now? What's been the response?
Yeah, we really have. We've gotten a great response from all of our users. Yeah, it's been really overwhelming. I mean, we got a message from this one older lady who said that she's been too scared to go out over the past 3 months, and she feels that this app gives her peace of mind that she needs. And so messages like that definitely make us feel good and make us feel like, you know, this app is very helpful to people.
Now, is it mostly locally owned mom-and-pop stores, or can I say, let me look up the Walmart in Schererville to see what they are their protocols? Are the big box stores on there?
Yeah, we have Costco's, we have Whole Foods, we have pretty much, you can add any business you would like. It doesn't just have to be a smaller business.
So, Sam, after you guys get so successful with money and everything, what color is your Learjet going to be when you visit Jack in Utah?
That still has to be decided.
How do you feel about this? It's not only just, I can't imagine developing an app at my age, but alone 15 and 18 years old, it's got to be just an incredible experience to not only develop this app that people want to use, but you guys have been kind of celebrities now. How does it feel?
Well, it's definitely been a really great experience for us. And really helping us through all this journey was all this information that we've gotten over the years. We've had the opportunity to have a great education. So from our teachers, combined with our great interest in technology in general, we've been very fortunate to be able to work with hands-on with a lot of technology, and that's really helped guide us and throughout this process.
All right.
Yeah, I would add to that. I feel like we're definitely overwhelmed with the positive feedback we've gotten so far. And, you know, it is a continued learning process for all of us. So we're still learning, you know, even now as we're continuing the process. So, yeah, it's still a learning opportunity for all of us.
Jack, do you anticipate you and Sam continuing to develop the app even when you go off to college?
Yeah, I do anticipate that. We're actually currently working on a version 2 right now. That's going to have some new features like advanced search filters so people can more easily find businesses. And we're even adding a new category, because right now we have 5 categories. We have grocery, dining, retail, personal care services, and entertainment. We're also adding a new travel category. So that will include like airlines, hotels, and stuff of that nature, since we know a lot of states are opening back up and people obviously aren't going to stay at home forever.
Great. And what kind of brothers are you guys? Are you guys generally pretty close to begin with because you're brothers, or do you still, when I was your age, I would fight a lot with my brother, but do you guys get along pretty well?
Thankfully, yeah, it's been fairly easy for us throughout this process. We haven't argued too much about who is handling what part of the app so far. He's mainly handled the actual app, and I've been more of the website guy. So,
all right. Well, good luck. Continue success. And I may end up calling you again to see how's it going. And good luck in college, Jack. And
thank you,
Sam. This has been great. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that was Jack and Sam Landmesser of Munster, Indiana, the developers of the Safe Shopper app. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
There's nothing like a good snapping hot dog. Travel with Let's Eat to Lowe as we visit with Dickie's Dogs. We'll be sitting down with the big dog, Nick, owner and operator, and his manager, Billy, from Dickie's Dogs. Listen in as we eat the tastiest hot dog in Lake County. Dickie's Dogs also offers an array of sandwiches, wraps, ice cream, and of course, my favorite, the hot dog. Call in and ask about their new restaurant or food truck, 769-9577, and win a gift card from Dickie's Dogs of Lowe and Chef Nick's Eatery from Winfield. Tune in to Let's Eat with Sharon Jackson and me, Chef Nick, live from our Maryville studios this Friday at 3 o'clock as we eat hot dogs with Dickie's Dogs on WLPR, Lakeshore Public Radio. Call in and join the fun. Ciao.
The governor says masks are mandatory. The attorney general says you can't do that. Plus, Democrats are calling for a special session to deal with COVID funding, police reform, and vote by mail. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll go over the week's biggest statewide headlines and hear from the author of a new book on the Olympic athletes who came out of IU. And a new Notre Dame study suggests many people were isolating themselves at the beginning of the pandemic before the state orders came down. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Coronavirus has zapped a lot of our summer fun activities, parades, sporting events, and even carnivals. No Laker Porter County County Fairs, no riding Ferris wheels or getting on those spinning things that upset my stomach. Okay, that's actually a good thing. And no throwing away money on those games. Well, honestly, I do miss those times. And I'm sure you do too. My next guest traveled the country as a carnival worker. He's a former award-winning reporter and a former colleague of mine at the Daily Herald in Arlington Heights. Michael Sean Comerford is the author of American Oz, Hitchhiking from California to New York, Alaska to Mexico. Mike, welcome to Off Mic.
Hey, Mike. Very good. Hi.
Hi, how are you? How are you?
All right.
Well, let's get to it. This book is fascinating. It's a really fascinating look at Americana and traveling. It's just not merely working for carnivals. You're really a great storyteller. Let me ask you this, though. Before we get into all this, tell us, how long were you a journalist for, and what happened to where you got to become a carnival worker? But first, how long were you a journalist?
About 30 years of my life, so I'm now in my 60s. So I started in my early 20s, and I've been a newspaper reporter and editor here in the Chicago area and New York, in Budapest, Hungary, and in Moscow.
Just a few places, right?
Well, you know, a little bit international, and so I've worked with the big papers and the small papers, and I worked with you proudly, and so I've been. I learned a little bit about storytelling, and so the profession kind of was drying up in a lot of ways,
right.
and I looked to change my profession. So I wanted to become a book writer. One of the ideas had been that as a younger man, I was out west, and I spent a weekend in a carnival, and I worked with them on a 4th of July weekend in Wyoming, in Cody, Wyoming, named after Buffalo Bill Cody, a great showman of the late 1800s, early 1900s. And I thought these people were great traveling secrets. And I was wondering, boy, this kind of this road life, what is it like to live on the road and all the time? And who are these people? They seem to be great, colorful characters. And so I kind of in the back of my mind thought, well, if I ever write a book someday, maybe I'll write about these people. And sure enough, in my mid-50s, I was transitioning out of newspapers and into books, and this is what I came up with.
And tell me, Mike, what year are we talking about when you decided to join the carnival?
I joined in 2013, February of 2013, and left in 2014. And I've been rewriting the book ever since. It's been deepening with every new draft until you saw, you've been reading it now, and I think it's a much better book with the passage of time.
Let me ask you this. Was the joining the carnival the sort of the conduit to writing the book, or was it something where you had to join a carnival to make money, and that became sort of the your material to write a book?
Well, it was both. I'm kind of a fan of immersion journalism, and so this is a bit of journalism in itself. Ted Conover and even Upton Sinclair in The Jungle. He wrote. He spent 6 weeks in the meatpacking houses and back of the yards in Chicago when he wrote The Jungle. And I just felt like if I worked shoulder to shoulder with carnival people, both in rides and in games, I'll feel what they feel, I'll see what they see, and I'll be able to write more clearly and vividly about living the life will help me write about the life. So that's the way it did turn out, too.
Okay, Mike. I mean, you did a lot of traveling, and there's a lot of fun moments in there. I don't know if it was fun at the time because you did a lot of hitchhiking. You did things that I think a lot of people would consider somewhat dangerous or living off the edge a little bit. It seems like the journey started out in California and Oakland. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that, those first few days working at a carnival?
Well, I jumped on the Zephyr, which is a Chicago to San Francisco train, and then I got out there and I went to work originally for a professional wrestler who actually wrestled on the circuit with people like Hulk Hogan and things like that. And when he eventually decided he didn't want a writer in his group, he fired me immediately. He said, look, you have a stupid idea here because owners don't want writers on their carnivals, and you don't speak Spanish. And in the big shows, a lot of them are Hispanics. They're from Mexico, Mexicans.
Right.
And he said, look, you're not speaking to the Mexicans. You're not, the owners aren't going to want you around. I just don't see how this is ever going to work. And after he finished that conversation with me, I go, well, that's easy enough. I'm going to go to Mexico. I'm going to befriend the Mexicans who can speak English, and I'll learn some Spanish myself.
Sure.
And I will not tell anybody that I'm writing blogs. I wrote blogs, and I wrote for magazines, and I wrote for Huffington Post,
Were you writing this as you were working with the carnivals? Okay.
And I risked. Carnivals have a tradition, which isn't very pretty. If there's an infraction in the carnival, you were in for a beating. And some of these carnivals were old fashioned, and I was risking a serious beating. Some of these beatings put you in the hospital, but very nearly near death. Beatings can be.
Yeah.
And absolutely. So I was posting often, and every night I would go after my work, which used to be quite long, depending on the place I was in. I would go straight to a McDonald's or to a Denny's and use their Wi-Fi, or I'd use my laptop in my bunkhouse and I would write. And religiously, I wrote till late in the morning. Everything I saw that day, everything I heard that day, and I would write blogs every few days, and no one caught on. And so I became a spy, I put in the book. I went from being a kind of a journalist that would be a kind of a third party kind of person that would be objectively looking at the lives of carnival workers and carnivals and how they work and how all the lessons of life on the road, to becoming one of them and suffering the same things that they do. And,
well, let me ask you this, Mike, how are you able to, like, in some of these journeys, you were hitchhiking, you were taking,
I think I became the number one hitchhiker in America because I double checked with all the internet sites. I talked to all the top hitchhikers in the country, and I believe hitchhiking 14,000 miles to Alaska, across country twice, down to Mexico, I believe I was the number one hitchhiker in America. Go ahead.
Well, you did see how Mexicans play a role in, I mean, we hear how Mexicans take a lot of jobs in America that a lot of Americans don't want.
Right.
And carnivals is one of them, working on the farm fields in another. How are they generally treated? Because we do know in the farm fields, they can be treated very poorly. How are they generally treated at these carnivals?
Well, it depends on who you ask, and I think it's just like a lot of things. It depends on your point of view, depends on whether you are the one that suffered the problem or not. But there is wage theft, there is bait and switch, there are bad practices. So the year that I was on this trip around the carnivals and around America, a major study came out called Taken for a Ride, and in it, it alleged many of these poor practices, like poor living conditions, low wages, long hours, and bait and switch. People were coming up from Mexico told they were going to get a great construction job, and they actually got a carnival job, which, you know, is lower wage and also long hours.
You know, but Mike, I do got to say, your book is also a very sweet book. In that you have an eight. Well, at the time, you had an 8-year-old daughter named Grace, and at the time, you were on the East Coast near New York, and you had to somehow make it back to Chicago for her eight year birthday, and obviously funds were tight, so you hitchhiked, and how I mean, at some point, you got to tell yourself, like, man, is this worth it for a book? But you persevered.
Yeah. I'm glad that you brought that up too, Mike, because you're a family man and you have daughters. And it breaks your heart sometimes when you're talking to your daughter and she misses you.
Absolutely.
And this is what carnival people go through. So this is where the immersion journalism kicks in, because they're gone from home for 9 months. The Mexicans are certainly way they're in a different country, but the Americans from the United States, they're gone for the entire season, 6 months or more, and they're away from their family, and they're feeling that same separation. And that's what I felt, and I tried to portray, because she felt it deeply.
I'll forgive you, though, when the truck driver took you from Kalamazoo and dropped you off in Gary, and you didn't call me for a ride to Chicago. I would have given you a ride. You should have called me. But I do got to say, too, but you also found yourself in the Chicago area where you were working for a company called Modern Midway, and you were on the south side or west side of Chicago, kind of a gang-infested area.
Yep.
But you brought joy to a lot of the young African-American kids who they know a lot of violence. They see a lot of the trouble around their neighborhood, but they get to go to the carnival to have fun, especially on this Dumbo ride that you were working on. That must have felt great in a sense that you were so close to home, but also odd that you were also so far from home at the same time.
Well, yeah, it's you know, it's all perspective. You know, life is so many perspectives. And these are rough neighborhoods. We were in Gage Park at 55th and Western. And at the time, it was described, you know, to us as a dividing line between Hispanic gangs and black gangs. And then we were on Midway Plaisance, right on the border of Washington Park and Jackson Park. And Midway Plaisance is, plays a very big part in carnival history, because American traveling carnivals trace their history back to the 1893 World Columbian Exposition.
Right.
And when it was right there at where the University of Chicago is now, was the biggest World's Fair in all of history. And 62, you know, it was millions and millions, like over half the country, they claimed had gone through their turnstiles. And
just an amazing book, Michael. Michael Sean Comerford is the author of the new book, American Oz, An Astonishing Year Inside Traveling Carnivals at State Fairs and Festivals. I'm sure sooner or later, this is going to be a movie on Netflix or something. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic.
Well, it is great to talk to you, Mike, and I hope you help your readers to go out and check it out on Amazon, American Oz, An Astonishing Year in Traveling Carnivals.
Thank you, Mike, again. Thank you so much. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
The governor says masks are mandatory. The attorney general says you can't do that. Plus, Democrats are calling for a special session to deal with COVID funding, police reform, and vote by mail. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, we'll go over the week's biggest statewide headlines and hear from the author of a new book on the Olympic athletes who came out of IU. And a new Notre Dame study suggests many people were isolating themselves at the beginning of the pandemic before the state orders came down. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Yes, today is the start of the baseball season. Both the White Sox and the Cubs open their seasons today. You can't see me, but I do have my white pinstripe White Sox jersey on in the studios here at Lakeshore. If I'm like most fans, I'm excited, but also a little apprehensive and hoping the players don't get sick. Joining us to talk about the start of the baseball season is veteran sports reporter for WBEZ, Cheryl Ray Stout. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
I'm good, Michael. There's a lot of news going on today besides baseball.
Okay, well, let's first talk a little bit about baseball. I'm not going to tell you which jersey you have on, probably just something that says WBEZ on it. But did you ever think we would make it to this point, start of the season?
No, I didn't. I thought it would be, you know, a long shot, but we still have to hold our breath to make sure they could get through this 60-game season, because we found out yesterday when the Nationals started, they lost one of their stars, Juan Soto, to COVID. So, you know, anything can happen. Unfortunately, I have to think that way because they have to travel.
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they're not playing in a bubble like the NBA. And do you think maybe that would have been a better idea, just to get teams in a bubble, or are there just too many players?
Too many players, too difficult to do. There's no way to do. You have way too many people in baseball as opposed to basketball. And basketball is a real easier sport to do it with.
So just give us a quick rundown for the Cubs. Where are they starting their games at and the White Sox?
Well, both of them are going to be home. Nice thing for the MLB to do it that way. The Cubs are going to be hosting Milwaukee. They got Kyle Hendricks on the mound for them as their starter. They've got their veteran core back. They have a new rookie manager in David Ross, so that's going to be interesting.
Right.
Their starting rotation, I think, has some question marks because you lost Jose Quintana to a thumb injury, so that's for them to think about. They're going to have the DH, so they now get to implement that all season. Marquee finally made a deal with Comcast today, this morning, so Cub fans can now watch if they have Comcast. The White Sox, they have an exciting situation right now. They have Lucas Giolito on the mound today. The one thing about Lucas, he really had a breakthrough season last year, but you look at the breakthrough seasons of Tim Anderson, and you look at Yoan Moncada, and you look at Eloy Jimenez, and you add in Luis Robert. He's going to be a Rookie of the Year candidate all season long for 60 games. But when they added the free agents of Dallas Keuchel, he'll be starting tomorrow. You add in Yasmani Grandal, an all-star catcher, going along with all-star catcher James McCann. There's a lot of good things. And when Encarnacion, they finally have a solid DH. There's a lot of good things to say about the White Sox adding to their young core with veterans that should round off a good team.
You know, when people look back on this season, let's say they make it through the entire season in the World Series, is there going to be an asterisk right there? I mean, to me, it just feels like, you know, let's just go with the flow. And yeah, it's different, but it's baseball.
I think from what I've experienced, from what I've talked to these managers, both the White Sox and the Cubs managers, when I've talked to the players on Zoom calls and the general managers, there's a lot of emotional stress these guys have been going through from day one. I don't think there should be an asterisk. I think you just mentioned the shortened season, but what they've been going through emotionally, This is really tough, Michael. They've been going through
a
lot.
I'm sure it is. So what other news is out there?
Well, the Bears just released to their season ticket holders that they will refund all ticket money for this year or credit for next year. Right now, they don't know about having fans in the stands, so season ticket holders could buy single-game tickets. That's big news. The Blackhawks are getting ready to go to Edmonton on Sunday to begin their bubble situation with Edmonton. They'll be playing a five-game series with them the following week. You have the Sky. They're opening up their season on Sunday. The Chicago Sky's open their WNBA season on Sunday on national TV against the Las Vegas Stars at 2 o'clock on ABC. That's a big deal. They've got a mix of good veterans and some young players that's going to make their up-tempo team. They're also going to be really promoting social injustice issues. All the players will be wearing Breonna Taylor's on the back of their jersey, so that's the watch. And also the Chicago Red Stars, they're going to be on national TV on Sunday, too, because they're playing in the Classic Championship in Utah against Houston. They're going to be on CBS at 11:30. So, Michael, there's been a lot of news today.
A lot of news, a lot of actual sports to report. Yeah, that's a little different, huh?
Yeah, the thing, you know, when you look, I want to bring up the Blackhawks, not having Corey Crawford, we don't know why, because they have labeled it unfit to participate. That's going to be very hard for them to be able to proceed. But I want to bring up with baseball, tonight they're going to start with 30 players on the roster. They'll have them for 2 weeks, and then after that it will be down to 26. They will have their taxi squads. The White Sox will have theirs in Schaumburg at Boomer Stadium. The Cubs will have theirs at South Bend, Indiana with theirs. So they'll be able to bring players up if they need it. A lot of pitching will be going through on these teams.
Wow. And what are you looking for tonight's game openers for both the Sox and Cubs?
I just want to see good baseball. It's, Michael, it's been very eerie. I've gone to the games this week. It's dark. It's kind of strange. Having no fans. But just having baseball played normally as you can. I want to see the hitters, you know, produce. I want to see Luis Robert at the plate and Eloy Jimenez at the plate. I want to see what's going to happen with Anthony Rizzo being back from his back injury. He had a home run his first at bat the other night. If Chris Bryant can play a full game, he had back injuries. So there's a lot of questionable things, but a lot of good things all in the mix. It's going to be exciting, at least some part. It's 60 games. They're playing against their divisional opponents, you know, almost the whole time. Right. So you will finish the season with something very important to grab. And they're adding more teams to the playoff, too. So there's more chances.
Well, Cheryl Ray Stout is WBEZ's veteran sports reporter. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us here again on Off Mic.
Anytime, Michael.
Thank you. And that's all the time we have for today's show. I'd like to thank my guests and my producers, Jose Rodriguez, El Hombre, the fabulous D. Donson, and El Wapo Tamaloni. You can hear this show again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. For me, Michael Puente, you can hear me the rest of the week on WBEZ. But for the staff at Lakeshore Public Radio, have a nice weekend, stay safe, and mask up.